It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Stacey has the week off, but there's lots of news from Google Cloud Next. Jeff Jarvis will help parse it all for us from the City and University of New York. And our open web guru, Kevin Marks, is here. We'll also talk about Google's quarterly results, Facebook's disappointing results, and a whole lot more. This Week in Google is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by CacheFly, CacheFly.com. This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 466, recorded Wednesday, July 25th, 2018. Ich bin nicht einverstanden. This Week in Google is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google, the show where we talk about the latest news from the Googleverse, which includes the Facebookverse, the Twitterverse, the Obverse, and the Reverse. Here he is. All the way from New York, New York, the Town Knight Professor of Journalism at the University of New York Graduate School of Craig Newmark Journalism, Jeff Jarvis. Without my cheat sheet, I don't really...
Hey. Good to see you.
Great to see you. There it is. The Leonard Town Professor for Journalistic Innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. And director of the Town Knight Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. Blogger at BuzzMachine.com, at Jeff Jarvis on the Twitter.
And, as I always say, co-host of This Week in Google.
You say that?
I do, constantly.
I'm flattered. That's very nice. Thank you. I'm glad that that's something to your
it's
credit.
It's in my bio.
Yes, in your bio.
Yes, it is.
Also with us all the way from Oxfordshire in the United Kingdom. Formerly... Yorkshire, I don't know. It's in a shire. He's in a shire somewhere. Kevin Marks of the Indie Web. Hey, Kevin.
Hey there. Nice to see you. It's been a while.
It's been a long time, and I'm glad that we could get you to fill in for Stacey. She's actually, oddly enough, at Google Next, just up the road a piece, but she's busy.
Where Sundar spoke. Surprise
Sundar, was that unexpected at Cloud Next?
Yeah, that's what they said.
Yeah, he's the CEO of Google. It seems like it's just up the road a piece. It shouldn't be that weird that he showed up.
Yeah.
He says we're, and he said this, I feels like he said this at Google I.O.
I think so too.
We're at an inflection point as an industry with AI. Just a few years in, we've seen some incredible use cases, especially in healthcare. He was talking about, I gather, according to this story from the street, a Google-built algorithm that could detect heart attack or stroke risk through retinal scans. Is this one of the Google Health moonshots? He also unveiled a slew of new AI technologies across Google Cloud and G Suite. I forget. You can use G Suite, right, Jeff? It's just that you can't merge your G Suite account with your regular.
Yeah, account. I'm absolutely on G Suite. That's how I have my email and everything. It just means that it causes me hell, but I'm there. I'm paying it every month. Yep.
They actually, because some good news, if you've wanted to use Google Storage as a business without using G Suite, they now have unbundled that. So that's good news.
Surprised that was, I didn't know that was the case all these years.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah, that you had to buy both. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to add some, I think what's really interesting is the maturation of Google's office suite on the cloud and how it is now getting closer and closer to kind of a mainstream desktop office suite. For instance, they're going to use the Google AI to do grammar. Now, there's the story, by the way. Carson's just pulled it up on how you can get Google Drive storage without getting Google Suite. So that's good news. But they're doing, in fact, if I were Grammarly, I'd be a little nervous about this because everybody who uses the Google suite of office tools will, I gather, get grammar underlining now in their thing. That's 4 million people use the G Suite. Let's see. Google infuses more AI into the G Suite. Several new capabilities. Features focus on reading, writing, and meetings on the writing front. Smart reply in Hangouts chat. That's good. I use Hangouts still because I'm a Google Fi customer. So you can get quick replies in your chat room. I haven't seen it yet, but I gather we'll get it soon. If anybody use Smart Replies, do you use it in your Gmail, Jeff?
Oh, all the time.
You do?
All the time, yeah.
So it's pretty
good. I
feel
guilty every time I do it. I feel like I'm going to be found out.
You don't care about me. I got that reply last week, Jeff.
But I you know, that's going to be happening more and more and more. One other story in the rundown is that Google's going to bring its AI human-voiced Fulia people into their call centers.
Oh, this Google duplex thing?
Yeah, so they're going to start. They're going to start implementing that in call centers, which means. Uh-oh. I mean, it's always been there to some extent. You always deal with the stupid voicemail jail, but presumably this will be far better.
Well, it's pretty clear when you use chat, and that's how Google and a lot of companies want you to interact, at least a first line interaction. That's a bot. Hi, it's David. What can I do for you today? It's clearly not David.
Right.
Right. Yes.
And then you can actually sense the handoff.
David.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's robot David. But then you can after some interaction, then I think sometimes there's a handoff because you can kind of feel like, oh, David just became sentient.
Yeah.
That could be a bad thing. What else? New investigation tool for G Suite Security Center. I don't know what that even means. Helps admins remediate threats. Voice commands and Hangout Meet hardware. I think the grammar is a beta thing that you can sign up for. That you have to. That's an early adopter program. Grammar suggestions in Google Docs.
I mean, they've done these things before. There's three or four of those already, isn't there? I remember one a while from probably 8 years ago where they were trying to do this. Google Suggest or something where you started typing things.
Oh, yeah. That sounds familiar. Yeah.
So, I mean, that was a bit Markov Cheney. It was amusing in that it would keep auto completing famous sentences and things.
But, right. Like the religious texts that Google Translate was offering.
That. Yes.
So
that was a great
story. So if you typed, and I think they've fixed some of this, but if you typed nonsense in, and one example was dog, 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 and then had it translate to Maori.
Or from Maori.
Or from Maori into English, it would give you, it looked like chapter and verse from the Bible. It looked like Revelations.
Who the hell discovered this?
That's a good question. But I posited that it might be Markov chains because it did feel like that. Like I think it's snippets.
More, it's more subtle than Markov chains, but it's in a similar issue. The discussion in there was basically saying they don't have many parallel texts, and so they will pick up stuff that was in the text they have used. I remember when they first put out Google Translate, they'd used it on a lot of EU texts because there's parallel text there, and they're sort of businessy. But they would, if you put in Blair, it would say Sarkozy. Because it would translate the Prime Minister of England to the Prime Minister of France by name. And there was a bunch of, you could make it do things like that before. And it's a challenge of all these things. The other thing that they said in there is that what they try and do, they have two training sets. They have a training set of parallel texts, which is to try and find correspondences. But they also have a large training set in the target language where they try and find coherence. That makes sense to the sentence. So if you give it nonsense, it will try and generate the most coherent thing it can make from the nonsense rather than giving you nonsense back.
Right.
Which is a change from the previous. The previous behavior was if it didn't know what was going on, it would just pass the text through.
Right. Which would be the right translation of dog, 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 or egg, 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 egg. And I don't, to me, this did not bother me. This seemed to bother Motherboard. They wrote the story. If you pass something nonsense, all bets are off.
But the thing is, you don't know if you don't speak the language, you don't know when it's doing something a bit like that.
Right.
But the difficulty with a lot of this AI stuff is when you move outside the space that it's been trained on, weird things happen. And so there was a similar thing a while back where Because, again, parallel text problem, because a lot of the parallel texts in Arabic were translated by the State Department and people like that, it would give very warlike and inflammatory things if you translate to from Arabic.
Oh, God.
Because they'd be trying to, because the texts were translated from the kind of rants and things like that they had. Whereas if you get classical Arab literature, it give you odd translations of it, things like that. And it is a hard problem because it's hard to know. Translation is a deep, hard problem for humans. And you can throw machines.
That's for sure.
The machines have got better, but you don't know. Nobody actually understands what's going on inside these things. They're building some kind of intermediate representation, but it's not something you can inspect easily. When they inspected it visually, we got the deep dream stuff and spooky, many-eyed dogs in trees and all that nonsense.
Right.
And that's partly because a lot of the training sets there, the original training set that a lot of the AI image recognition stuff was on, was very highly populated with pictures of dogs and different breeds of dogs, because that was one of the things they were trying to test it on. And so it started seeing dog faces everywhere because it had a lot of dog faces in the training set. And it's similar things with, as they do more of this, the worry about what you're training it on gets stronger. There was a great thing by Pete Warden on this. Would you know if you had Pete Warden on? Did you get Pete on?
No.
He's one of the guys at Google AI who works in dev relations. He's English too, so I've obviously got a connection with him. But he's written some great stuff about this. And one of the things he said was, if you're doing academic AI, you spend all your time thinking about models and structure. And if you're doing practical real world AI, you spend all your time worrying about your data sets and are they clean enough and are they doing the right thing and can you tighten them up and do better things with them. I'll see if I can find the piece, but it's.
He's got an article on Medium from a couple of years back called TensorFlow for Poets. I'm not sure exactly. I guess this would be a good way to. It's not writing poetry. I don't know what it is.
It's like you're in the course.
Yeah, physics for poets. Got it. So it's for non-technical people.
Yes.
For idiots.
Yeah.
I found the one I was thinking about. Where should I put it? I'll put it in the chat room.
What image classifiers can do about unknown objects?
That's another. I haven't read that one. That's a new one.
This is new on his blog. Yeah.
The one I was talking about was two down from this. Why you need to improve your training data and how to do it.
Yeah, it's nice that they've got somebody a human talking about this. This is good. So I recommend this. It's PeteWarden.com, PeteWarden. And we will try to get him on. That would be.
You should get him on. I mean, he's allowed to speak for Google. He does dev relations on machine learning and things. He'd be a great guest.
Make a note of that, Karsten. It'd be fun. Because honestly, I feel like often when we talk about these issues, we talk from a ignorant point of view. And that's why I'm glad to get somebody like you, Kevin, on and who could set us straight. About things like this translation issue. Is this something? Well, somewhat. You're more technical than I am, and you worked at Google, so you know some people. It did not bother me that we were getting Bible verses, but it did bother some people. And translated from Somali to English, comes out as the name of the Lord was written in the Hebrew language. It was written in the language of the Hebrew nation. Wow, That's a kind of a stretch.
Yeah.
It shouldn't. It probably shouldn't do that. I think it's harmless, but it shouldn't do that.
Well, it's not harmless in that you don't know what else is going on. That's the
right.
Problem.
You could be giving it perfectly reasonable text and still get Deuteronomy.
Which is the problem with AI as a rule. And it's about how can you possibly audit the performance?
Right.
If people talk about auditing the algorithms. That's ludicrous. Audit the output, but when you get that kind of, that's what scares me. Is you think, who would think to put in egg to audit the output?
Right.
Well, people have done that. They put in stuff like that to make it to do Google speech to the drum machine. So and to try and get different like accents from different languages and things. But this is a very strange, this is a very strange problem, and it's. And it's a big problem with a lot of this AI stuff is you don't always know what's going to come out, you don't have a good understanding. There's no straightforward way of understanding what the shape of of the world inside it is for a lot of these problems.
Right.
So you're basically saying, you're basically giving it, you normally give it a training set and what you want things to look like and get it to correlate those. And then you give it a test set that's similar to the training set but distinct and see what it does with that. But there's less of a likelihood of you to give it some strange noise. Now there are some training models where they have what they call an adversarial AI, where you have another AI who's trying to find the cracks in the first one.
Right.
That's where they've done things like come up with images that fool a large set of AIs that have all been trained on ImageNet, for example. So you can change a few things and it'll think a gun is a turtle or things like that. Because it's hard to understand. You know, you have to treat these things as black boxes and test them empirically, and it's very hard to do that when you've only got a known set of training sets. And so that essay by Pete is very good on this. He's basically saying the most significant thing you can do is improve your data and have a good feel for the data you're feeding it and what you're trying to feed it. And one of his anecdotes in there was when he was building an app, they ended up by hand training it with reacting to 2 million images between a team of 6 of them because they couldn't find a way to get people to do that for them.
So it brings us back to Pichai's comments at Google Cloud Next this week. Are we at an inflection point? It feels like we're really still pretty primitive.
Well, you know, Google has been wanting to do this for a very long time, and they're better at it than almost anyone else. So, but the question is, how does it work in domains where the problem isn't well defined? And you know.
So, in other words, well, if you're like, trying to find heart problems or that's because that's a more, it's just the same thing as, I guess, as a speech dictation in a more constrained environment does a better job than in a kind of a general.
But the example that everybody's using these days, you know, when it comes to dealing with fake news and harassment and those kinds of things at a scale where they're killing a million fake accounts a day, then, you know, those are subtle, nuanced things to try to figure out.
No, I mean that was one of the other, you know, apart from the obvious shocking things Zuckerberg said last week. The other one he said was, "Oh yes, we're using AIs to do this. We're using AIs to lead our humans in the right direction." It's like,
boy, that seems like a bad idea.
Backwards.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, but also, you know, they've already got a problem that they're trying to understand nuanced communication with minimum wage people who have a evaluate per hour target, and then they're feeding the results of that into an AI and then using that to create a feedback loop to those people. So if you can find an ag type attack on Facebook, you can do the kind of influence that we've already seen. And that is what they were blind to from the, you know,
right,
the Russian exploit networks, which basically systematically looked at this and said, okay, let's experiment with the edges of this and see what we can do to amplify things. If our goal is to amplify things in a noisy way and cause chaos rather than game the advertising system, which is what Facebook was optimizing for, then it's a very different problem set.
Do you think, so I'm a little cynical, as Jeff will vouch for, about Mark and Facebook. Do you think that they actually believe AI is the solution for this, or they just know that, like the word blockchain, AI is a good thing is like fairy dust to sprinkle on any solution?
Well, I think they believe it.
I don't know which is worse, cynical marketing tech speech or believing something that's patently flawed.
Well, they
flawed.
Also want to believe it desperately. I wrote a piece this week about, you know, I finally had to come down on the, you know, because I, full disclosure, I accepted money at my school for Facebook. I received no money myself. I'm independent of Facebook. But because I've done that, I had to come out and say what I thought about the InfoWars stuff. And my view strongly is that InfoWars should go down, but it's really hard to come up with a rule set.
Yeah, we talked about this last week. What is the rule? What is the rule? You call it finding the line.
And I quoted you in that piece because Zuckerberg's line was that an imminent cause of violence. And you said, no, harm is the right way to put the line, and I agree with that. But harm is hard to define,
right? Yeah. But if Alex Jones says that that somebody should, if he mimes taking a shot at Robert Mueller, that strikes me as a threat of harm.
Yeah, clearly the rules are bad. That, if it, didn't, it doesn't
that
get
crosses
rid of
the rules. That line for sure,
yes,
to me.
Yes.
And if, by the way, and one of the reasons I kind of know this is, you know, if you get threats on Twitter, as my daughter did many years ago, the first thing the police will say is, "Do you feel in danger? Do you feel in at risk of bodily harm from this threat? If you do not, then it doesn't rise to the cause. It's not a cause for action. If you do, then they can proceed." And they, in fact, we had a local Petaluma detective got a warrant, got the IP address from Twitter, then went to the internet service provider, got a warrant in Chicago, tracked down the person who'd made a violent threat against my daughter, who was probably 15 or 14 at the time.
Jesus.
And it was a kid. And but the police knocked on his door. And because it was a threat of harm, there was a physical risk of harm. So that's why I think that's the legal standard. At least it was in this case. You can't, and that's the whole First Amendment thing, shouting
right,
fire
the police
in a crowded
ball, that's
theater.
Ball, but Facebook can make its own decisions. You know, as
yeah,
I
Facebook
about
can do whatever it wants.
Last week.
Right, but you can't prosecute somebody unless
it's. Right, exactly.
Yeah. But that seems like a good, week. At least, that's a minimum, that's at the very minimum something Facebook should have at least that as its.
Well,
rule.
certainly the threats to individuals and harassment to individuals, yes, I think that's easy.
Yes,
and that's
going
down. Same for Twitter.
Even if, though he didn't say it out loud, but pointing a gun and saying Robert yeah. Mueller, that's.
Well, but so the argument that the Zuck makes here, and I try to argue back here, probably an argument I would have made 5 years ago, is free speech, is more different opinions, this and that. More
you want to bend
good.
Over backwards on behalf of free speech, that's for sure.
Not that he's going to listen to me, but I said to him in the piece, Mark, you're not responsible for free speech. That doesn't fall to you.
Yeah.
The Alex Jones has plenty of places where he can congregate with his cockroaches. He doesn't need Facebook to do that. You don't need him.
You don't have to facilitate that. Yes.
Yeah, and they've got to break out of that idea,
that's
I think.
That's really so question. He did the same thing with the Holocaust deniers. He said, well, I don't know. I don't understand their intent. I don't think they're intentionally denying
they're
the Holocaust.
They're so scared of having to make rules that are hard to enforce, that require people and expense, that are going to get them in trouble with certain, you know, trolls. We're going to go after them. But, you know, Facebook, you're their chump now.
Is the part of the problem? Is part of the problem that social media and the amplification effect of social media has flipped on its head the old rule that the best that free speech doesn't help Nazis; it helps you get rid of Nazis. That used to be the rule.
Yes. That's a good point. You know, the more speech is better rule yeah. when we have no end of speech possible. You know, I don't know, Leo. The hard thing is, again, we keep paying attention to the bad end of the cycle and trying to play whack-a-mole with that. We need better systems to just ignore the a-holes.
Yeah.
The underlying problem is that the systems are optimized for engagement.
Right.
And
it amplifies the a-holes.
You know, crying fire in a crowded theater is a great way to get engagement.
Right.
Causing stampedes in the digital world is a great way to amplify that too. And because of that, they've poisoned the broader discourse too, because that is now the editorial agenda, is say something controversial that will get you the hate share so that we get the traffic we need. And that is the sort of underlying problem with this. And the challenge is coming up with ways to do this that, something to optimize for that isn't that, that is, you know, how do you optimize for reasoned discourse? How do you apply, you know, the Popperian rule of do not tolerate the intolerable?
What do you make of Maureen Sullivan's Washington Post op-ed piece in which she said, Mark Zuckerberg is a horror show, but there's a glimmer of truth hidden in his latest blunder. She says to follow, this is the Margaret Sullivan who used to be the media ombudsman at the New York Times.
Right.
Who was so good in that job that they discontinued it after she left. They couldn't find anybody
as good. They had one more,
good.
But she didn't work out, so yeah.
To follow Mark Zuckerberg's utterances, she writes, is to constantly cringe. But then...
Yeah, I think horror show was a little strong in the headline.
Yeah, well, she might not even have written that headline, so I probably shouldn't have read that. But, Her point, what is her point? Somebody better explain it to me, because
Oh, crap. You know,
I think her point is what I just said, which is the best way that free speech helps you fight Nazis, doesn't promote Nazis, it helps you fight Nazis. She said, maybe imagine if instead of taking it down, Facebook appended a prominent disclaimer atop the Holocaust denial page. Widespread censorship and chasing down every falsehood ought to be acknowledged as bad ideas, writes Maureen Sullivan.
Yes, I agree with that. Nonetheless,
it's already Facebook marginalized voices that are likely to be silenced by that point of view.
That's true if it's too automated. But at some point, Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg himself has the full freedom to decide what is acceptable on the platform that he built.
Right.
And you know, that he, when he talks about free speech, which again, I would have done 5 years ago too, but the internet is not controllable. Facebook is by you, Mark.
Right.
So some people are begging you to control. Now, some people are saying, no, stay away. You can't make any judgment. You shouldn't be doing this.
Even worse, as Kevin says, maybe Facebook is actually doing the opposite simply in its normal operation by amplifying the most objectionable speech because that produces engagement. That's its algorithm. It's optimized.
Right, and that's why I think that even moving past clickbait and attention as the metric to trying to move to meaningful interactions between people I think that's going to move from clickbait to comment bait. And so the metrics still aren't right, and the metrics are too easy to game. The point here is it's not so much that Facebook is choosing to do this. It's that the bad guys recognize the weakness and exploit it to the fullest.
So following that news, Facebook had its quarterly results today, just minutes ago. Stock tumbled, but it's as usual, and this is why we often don't talk about financial markets because it's not necessarily correlated to anything we talk about on the show, but they missed their expectations. So revenue, it wasn't that revenue was down, it just wasn't as up as much as people had thought, by a small amount, frankly.
$13.23 billion in revenue.
Instead of $13.3 billion. Oh. Monthly active users, 2.23 billion. That's just an astounding number, instead of 2.25. Daily active users, 1.47 billion daily active users. And that was a little lower than the growth. It's not that it didn't grow. Again, it grew. It just didn't grow quite as much as expected.
They're not dying.
They're not dying.
But, you know, they've passed the point where they can grow. They're running out of humans.
They're running out of people. 1.5 billion people. That's a lot of people.
Well, that's why they're putting satellites up to get internet access.
Advertising revenue up 42% year over year to $13 billion. 91% of advertising revenue from mobile. So I've said this every quarter for the last few years. The real question about Facebook was, could they make the turn going from desktop revenue to mobile revenue? And yes. The answer is yes.
Yes.
91%. Now the question is, why they should just get rid of desktop. Wow.
They pretty much have. When I've complained, you know, 2 years ago when I complained about some UI thing just with people I know who work there on the desktop, they said, we don't care.
Yeah, they don't care. It's amazing how the worm has turned or whatever it is. It's not a worm exactly. It's amazing, unless it's a worm from the dune landscape. It's amazing how the giant worm has turned. Mobile is very successful. Look, Facebook's successful. The stock price going down does not reflect a lack of success. In fact, if I were a trader, I would say that's a buy signal right now. Go out and get it. Alphabet, let's talk about their results.
Well, before you get one little thing, there's a bug on Facebook that's been driving me nuts the last week.
Yeah,
since the weekend. So I have tweets going. You wouldn't know this, Leo, because you know you've gone back in time. But I have tweets that go automatically from Twitter to Facebook.
Oh and yeah, I've heard of that.
If you're retweeting something or the thing that is attached to your tweet often isn't coming across. So you have some statement.
What a surprise.
Says, ha, ha, ha. And then that's all. That's the whole tweet. People saying, are you nuts? What's going on here? There's no context to that on Facebook. So I go into Facebook and I kill those.
So
tweets,
you're saying
or
the link from Twitter is not, you know why? Because Facebook doesn't want any outbound links on.
No, it's something's broken. It's just broken. It could also be a photo. So you're reacting to something in a tweet.
Yeah.
And the thing, the artifact that you're reacting to doesn't go across. So if you're listening to Facebook, you fix that, please. Or Twitter. It could be because Twitter changed something, but Facebook nonetheless.
You could also, Jeff, do it by hand with something like if this, then that. And
But the challenge is it's a reply context. You know, Twitter doesn't even get this right in moments. So, what do they call it? Highlights. So they'll display something in highlights. And it's like, here's this tweet that lots of people retweeted. It's like.
It's very frustrating.
I think that's responding to something else with a photo in it, and I have no idea why this one is showing up here.
It adds to the overall feeling when I read Twitter that I've had a stroke and that suddenly a comprehensible world has become completely incomprehensible. But that's that's just Twitter.
But that's just Twitter and the context moving really quickly all the time.
Because moving or disappearing, or just disappearing. There's no context at all.
No, but they start with a joke formula, and then that becomes mutated into something else.
You got to show thread all the time,
and then you have some joke formula that is like, I don't understand why this is funny because it's a mutated version.
That's the meme of the moment, Kevin. You stay up with it. Try to keep up with us. Yeah.
Yes. Slaps roof of Twitter. Yeah.
So I'm sorry I derailed us there. You were about to say about Google.
Who cares? All right. All right, we'll do it. ABC.xyz, one of the best. By the way, I'm downloading the latest Chrome. Let's see. Chrome, I don't know. Maybe I won't. It's 67. I think it's with 69 that Chrome is going to start when you go to a site that's not secure, saying, danger, danger, Will Robinson, insecure site. What do you think about that, web standards guy? If you're not HTTPS, you're dangerous?
It doesn't say dangerous. It says insecure.
It's going to be red in a couple of months.
Well, it's already red when you click on the little eye. It says, if you go to my site, it says the connection to the site is not secure.
Oh, is that which one? Epigonibonimos?
KevinMarks.com. Does not have HTTPS.
Epigony. You're on Blogger, I thought.
I was on blog. Well, it's still there, but I've been KevinMarks.com.
So now it says, you can see, it's kind of hard to see, but it says not secure up here.
Well, which should be secure. That's on Blogger.
It's on Blogger, but it's not secure. And
Kevin.
Right now, it's not Kevin's fault.
Kevin.
And right now, it's kind of benignly white, same color as the rest of it. But in a couple of months, this fall, it's going to be a bright red, not secure. That, to me, is shouting fire in a crowded theater. Your connection to this site is not secure. You should not enter any sensitive information on this site because
then you know what's going to happen. You're going to be in an airport or you're going to be in a hotel or somebody's company, and they're going to start blocking all of that
because it's insecure.
Yes.
Well, no. I mean, the other thing is there's the irony is that you've got the opposite problem, which is when you're trying to connect through some damn Wi-Fi portal, you need an HTTP site. Because it can, then they can put up their crappy man in the middle thing to make you log in.
I understand the desire of HTTPS everywhere. I think it's a good thing.
I could say it as my thing. There's a site called neverssl.com.
really?
And its entire point is you put it into your address bar so that you know you've got one site that will always be HTTP, which means it can trigger the, hi, this is your hotel. Please enter the code you were given at reception thing.
Oh.
Because any HTTPS site can't trigger that.
Oh, wow. That's a huge problem. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so this is one of the challenges. Now,
are you talking about captive portals?
Yes.
So Apple has workaround
which
that they
are
do.
An evil thing.
They're evil to begin with, but everybody uses them. That's where you have to do a login before you can use the internet. Apple just senses a captive portal and sends you to an Apple site. Will that still work?
Google does that on Android as well.
Yeah.
That will still work because they've got an Apple site.
They're doing a redirect.
That is HTTP.
Yeah.
I think a couple of years ago, that site went down and all the Macs and iOS has lost their minds for a couple of hours.
Well, and also my wife, who's notoriously, she moves fast. She's impatient. Never waits long enough for the captive portal to pop up. She says, just the site's not coming up. So I go to, I think it's, is it captive.apple.com? Something like that.
But it, never SSL, you can remember.
Never SSL. I'll tell her that from now on. That will be the place to go. Okay.
Yeah, that will spawn the portal.
If you go to captive.apple.com, it's actually a very happy site. You just get one word, success. That's the happiest site on the internet. Success. I don't even, I'm succeeding. Or never SSL.com. This site will never use. So it is a good thing to have secure sites. It really is. It causes problems with captive portals, but they're broken to begin with.
Yes, we should get rid of captive portals. That would be a better answer.
Is there a better way to do that? Is there a reasonable way to do that?
The reason way to do that is to post the password to your Wi-Fi on the wall on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
You know.
But then I can't get you to agree to all my terms and capture your email address.
That's illegal now anyway, so shut up. It's illegal in California and Europe. So
wait a minute, what? they can't ask you to agree to their terms of service to use the internet? No, of course, because you're using their internet, their access. Why is that illegal?
They ask to track you and build a profile a lot of the time.
Right.
So a lot of them are illegal. You know,
because they're tracking you.
So many of these crappy portals are in retail establishments. They say, give me your email address before you continue.
Yeah,
That is a GDPR violation. It's a California law, whatever it's called, violation.
Right. Although that law is not in effect till 2020. So you have
that's some, a shame.
Yeah, I agree.
Because I'm waiting for all the trunk sites to ban people in California.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
The LA Times, I can't read from here anymore. When they do that to LA, that'll be even better. Mind you, that's assuming they last that long.
So they never. So this was all because of GDPR. They never fixed that.
Tons. Yeah, no, it's not just trunk papers. It's more. Yeah, I tried to get to a lot of places when I was in Europe. Couldn't get in.
Oh, I thought that was just because
carpal tunnel syndrome from having to click
Browser cookies thing. Everybody does that now.
It's beyond that now. It's beyond browser. Now, will you agree to our new rules? Will you agree that we're okay for this universe and all universes in all perpetuity? Okay. Thank you, Europe.
So Kevin just posted in the chat room the text, which says, unfortunately, our website is currently unavailable in most European countries. We are engaged on the issue. This is why I assumed, they're going to try to fix it, and committed to looking at options to support our full range of digital offerings to the EU market. We continue to identify technical compliance solutions that will provide all readers with our award-winning journalism. Until then, suck it. Suck it,
you
Euros.
European commies.
But my favorite one is NPR.org.
Really? They do it?
Really?
They have an agree and continue, and if you say decline and visit plain text site, you get this really responsive page.
Oh, nice. That's a good technical solution. The web, as it used to. Wow, that's
tunnel
awesome.
Bear and see what that's like.
Yeah, I'll have to go to Europe.
I'm putting the links in the chat. I'm not sure if they still trigger view, but this is what I get.
Oh, HTTPS text.npr.org. Wow, that's nice. I think I remember reading about this. Look how fine this looks. It's like a gopher site.
It's pretty snappy as well.
Oh yeah, loaded really quick because there's nothing but text. Now if I click the link, it does. It continues. Look at that. No images, no audio. The links are in blue with an underline. I love that. Our followed links in mauve and purple.
This is old school.
Look at that. That's beautiful. Man, I wish the web were still like that sometimes.
Yeah.
Can we write a plugin, Kevin, that does this?
Well, you can just disable JavaScript and CSS, but it won't.
Use links.
That will make things look bad.
There is.
Are there any gopher sites still alive?
Oh, yeah. There's tons.
There are.
Oh, yeah. It's much. That part of the web is still much like it always was. I wish Finger hadn't gone away, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I'm sure there was good security reasons why Finger was a bad idea, but.
Well, you have to know someone's email address. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was good. You just finger them. And then they would they would cough.
Cough, please, yes.
That turned into poking.
Yeah. This is what I've been kind of, this is a project I've been kind of interested in. It's called Broush. It's a modern text.
Oh, that's kind of fun, yes.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you have to have WebKit on your machine because basically it's using, it pulls the, it gets WebKit to render it. And then it,
and then some, turns it into text.
Turns it into text, which is hysterical. Text.brow.sh. The Browsh plain text client. You can use it by appending URLs like this. So you add what? Prepending or appending? If I add this to twit.tv, is it going to work?
Yeah. It says append URL to Browsh. Yes, yeah. That's what it's saying.
Oh, no. Like, and all I got was my salad. Append. Oh, that's pre. Oh, I was prepending it. Of course, you have to append it. I don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm just curious what you're going to get if you go to the text-only version. No, it didn't work. Oh, there's a slash here. Do I have to do HTTPS? No, it's not. It's Google doesn't like me. Anyway, speaking of Google, G is for Google. Speaking of Alphabet, investors, where's the Google's not a conventional. What is this? Where's the results? I want results. I went to abc.xyz. Here we go. Is this Q2 2018? Here it is. Yeah, second quarter 2018 results. Alphabet revenues. God, when I look at this stuff,
no.
I just go, this is 3 months we're talking. And this is in millions. $32 billion in 3 months. 32.6. Excluding fines, 32.6. So I guess the fines didn't affect the revenue, they affected the operating income. So the profit was only a mere $2.8 billion this quarter. Should have been 7.8, except for those jerky jerks in the EU. That took the margin down from 24% to 9%. So they only made 9%. I'm sad. Net income. I'm not sure how net income varies from operating income, but this is roughly the same. So everybody was happy, right? This is big, big bucks. They don't break it down very much. I really wish people... Like Other Bets lost more money this year, $732 million losses for Other Bets. That's Waymo's at Other Bets, right? Contact lenses are Other Bets. Moonshots are Other Bets. Google X is Other Bets.
It's not that much money.
No, they can afford to lose $732 million.
And what I wonder proportionally, what did Bell Labs cost AT&T?
Right. And of course, they didn't call it any of that. Yeah. So let's see here. Change from Q2 year over year, paid clicks on Google properties went up 58%. Cost per click went down 22%. Impressions on the Google Network member properties up a mere 1%. That's basically flat. Cost per impression on Google Network members properties up 14%. I'm no stock analyst, but it seems like that's all pretty good.
Yep.
If you make more money by charging less, you're doing something right.
Full disclosure is I have some Google shares.
Oh, well, you're not promoting Google. I have some in my retirement. Because I have index funds, do I still need to disclaim it?
No, everybody has.
I mean, I'm aware of it.
It counts as a blind trust, I think.
Yeah, I don't manage it. I don't say buy more Google or buy less Google. I just buy the S&P 500 and the an index fund. So I guess.
So inexorably getting more Apple, Google, and Amazon as they.
I'm getting Apple, Google, Amazon. I'm getting the fangs because what are you going to do?
Yeah,
everybody loves the fangs.
Amazon, which I also have, has been very good to me.
And to Jeff Bezos, who continues to be the richest man God's ever created. Actually, Maureen Sullivan got one fact wrong. She said Mark Zuckerberg was Harvard's richest graduate. And then somebody pointed out, Maureen, remember Bill Gates?
Margaret.
Margaret. Oh. Maureen Sullivan was the child actress in.
Also, neither of them graduated. So
that's right. So graduate's wrong. A student attendee.
They've got honorary degrees now each, I think. So
okay. So that does that make them graduates or just? No, Karsten, who went to Harvard, says no.
Honorands.
Karsten says no. But Karsten, you had to go for 4 years. You had to live in those awful dorms. Put up with that terrible food. You had to write a.
Karsten? What was your major?
English.
There you go.
Actually, I don't think I even ended up graduating with a major. I think I missed a couple of requirements.
But see, that's what I like about Harvard. It's a real gentleman's university. we'll give him the degree anyway. He worked hard. He's a nice boy. Don't you have to write a senior paper or something at Harvard?
That's what I didn't do. I didn't do a senior thesis, so I graduated general studies.
Oh, that ploy.
Yes.
Harvard Light.
Harvard Light. What house were you in?
Adams.
The
black shirt wearing artsy house.
The artsy house. All right. Now we've learned. I've worked with Karsten for more than 20 years, and I have now learned something I didn't know. Or else, more likely, I knew it but forgot because I don't care. No, I'm just teasing. Alphabet's other bets, we should clarify, include Loon, which has finally found a customer, one customer.
Oh.
Loon is going to provide internet access to somewhere in Africa. I've forgotten which country. Those are the balloons, the giant weather balloons. Yes.
Did they ever deploy over Puerto Rico?
Oh, I don't know. They were talking about that, weren't they? The Wing Autonomous Drone Initiatives, Waymo, other bets, Fiber, Verily, and Chronicle, which is their cybersecurity outfit.
100,000 people.
For Loon?
Yeah, in Puerto Rico.
Oh, they did do Loon in Puerto Rico. Okay, good. So they're not yet making money on any of these, but that's okay.
It's okay. It's all right.
The European fine, $5.07 billion, obviously had something to do with it. So that's interesting. It means that they paid it, right?
Well, yeah, they had to account for it.
Okay. They're putting money. They open an account at the Dime Savings and Loan and put the money in there. Actually, even at 0.1%, that could add up.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Well, they move it from one offshore account to another offshore account.
It's all in Ireland. It doesn't,
It's probably in Luxembourg now rather than Cayman Islands.
That's true, That's true, Kevin. It is kind of a way to repatriate some of the money, yeah.
They do. Once the judgment happened, they have 90 days to end the conduct.
Here's the thing. They tried to settle this.
Isn't that interesting?
This is why this is such a political act. On the EU's part, they don't want to settle. They want to bring them to justice.
The settlement said that we'll stop doing all the things. This thing, the Bloomberg story, secret offer to settle. Was it? I mean, secret. What is that? I mean,
I don't know that it was secret so much. Yeah. They do what you do. You approach them and say, "We will change our behavior." New?
Yeah. Did they say that? Did they address all of the? Issues that the EU had? Let's see. It didn't have to be that way.
Right.
Writes Bloomberg. Months earlier, when the company, already reeling from a €2.4 billion fine in the shopping case, made quiet attempts. Well, what are you going to do? Announce it? Of course. They're going to tweet it? Made quiet attempts. Tweet it in all caps.
They would have been better off tweeting it. They would have been better off saying, we will change our ways. Here's what we're willing to do.
They should have. Yeah. To settle the probe and to do it, it waited a year too long, according to Margarete Vestager. When a company wants to settle, it needs to reach out immediately after getting the EU's initial complaint. That didn't happen in this case, and then, of course, it takes the route that it has now taken. So, no surprises, says Vestager. I guess it doesn't say what the settlement offer was. I mean, if... How does
Well, they would have negotiated it, but they were willing to change behaviors.
Yeah. How does Google respond to this? I mean, they have to now do it in 90 days. How do they respond to this? What do? They say, okay, we'll stop bundling. They'd have to stop bundling Chrome in the Play Store and Android. Stop requiring companies that offer
it's ridiculous.
Google Services version of Android to from offering the un-Google Android. It's a big deal. Although, as you pointed out quite aptly, Jeff, last week, that causes confusion in the marketplace because you don't know what you're getting. Am I getting a Google Android phone or an Android phone?
Yeah.
Well, no, but also the challenge is that if you offer any phone with Google services, you have to offer all your phones with Google services. So that's the piece that they want to break. So it means if you're trying to give a parallel operating system, if you also ship phones that have Google's full approved version on, has to go everywhere thing. So that's one of the clauses they're trying to break. But the other browsers thing is a bit weird because you can install other browsers. And you know, there is the Microsoft remedy where they require them to give them a choice of browsers at install time.
That's as bad as the cookie announcement on the websites, which is also in response to the EU. So Greg Farrow on Sunday convinced me that there was an issue with Google's behavior, that in effect they preempted by giving away Android, by doing what they did, they preempted any competing operating system. They basically made Android into the monopoly that it is by convincing everybody, Samsung and Nokia.
What's wrong with that? That's becoming the monopoly is not a problem. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there wasn't anybody else stopping anybody doing it, but it was good for consumers. It was free. It made for cheaper phones.
Well, but no, it's the same issue. Competition. When Microsoft started giving away Internet Explorer, it actually killed Netscape because Netscape was charging for their browser. Microsoft gave away a browser.
And who won in that case? Who won?
Well, Netscape died. So
the consumers won.
Only because along comes Apple and Google and created competing browsers. Otherwise, Microsoft Internet Explorer.
We had to pay for a browser. We got a free browser. That on its face is good for consumers.
It's but bad for choice. It's dumping.
In the long run, it wasn't.
This is a long-standing. Intel did the same thing with its chips. It dumped its chips, and it killed competition. And then you could argue, tried to do the same thing with bookstores by undercutting bookstores, putting them out of business, and then they can raise it to this. Then they get the monopoly and they can raise it. That is a long-standing problematic and illegal behavior by a lot of companies. You can't dump.
What's Google raise the price on?
Well, eventually, if you own Android, they can do whatever they want.
But they haven't done it. And that's to become
the only competitor right now is iOS, and it's not much of a competitor anywhere but the U.S.
Right. But Android was, you know, largely in response to iOS, and because Google was very worried about being shut out of it. That was part of the reason. To put so much emphasis.
I understand that, but the question is to Google's behavior with Android, was it really to keep anybody else from entering the market against them?
No, it was a way. Kevin's right. It was a way to compete with iOS. And it was a very clever one.
No, I understand it was that, but it was also. But did they not dump Android in order to prevent competition?
No, well, they made an emphasis. I posted a link to something I wrote on this in 2011, but. They made an open source operating system, which is in line with Google, you know, values and behavior, and makes sense to build open source infrastructure. But they also separately created this contract where, in order to get access to Google's proprietary stuff like the App Store and Chrome rather than Chromium, and you know a bunch of other things that are actually quite useful like Maps, you have to sign a contract with them, and so they have to. So in order to get like the full experience of Android, you have to buy these things. You have to sign a contract to do that. And initially, a lot of people built these parallel universe Androids that had different stuff on. I mean, Samsung still does it. Every time you buy a Samsung phone, you get two copies of everything: the Google one and the Samsung one. And it's confusing as anything. But if Samsung wants to ship the Google version at all, they can't just make their own. You know, what was it called? Tizen. Yeah, they said, okay, let's try. You know, we're big enough. Can we build another OS? Well, you can, but you're going to have to make a subsidiary that only sells those phones, and that you can't brand them Samsung because you have a deal with Google to sell the Samsung.
Right. So in effect, Google killed it.
Yeah. Well, not killed it. I mean, they made it
economically not viable to make Tizen, to bring Tizen any farther forward. The only thing that Tizen ended up on was watches because it didn't violate their agreement with Google.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying is that Google, that is predatory behavior and is traditionally considered antitrust or trust busting or whatever it is. What's the opposite of monopolistic behavior?
Trust creating or whatever.
Trust creating, yes. So this article on your blog, Apeus Epigony, is called Two Faces of Android from January 4th, 2011. And actually, initially, this was my argument of why I felt like Google was being punished unfairly because they gave away Android. That's, you know, that's a good thing to have an open source version of the operating system. And so many people, as you point out, benefited for that. You called it a Cambrian explosion of new Android devices.
And it's a different market reality. I mean, we can't always use the analogs of a scarcity-based market and an abundance-based market.
Yeah, no, that's true. And that's, you know, and I'm a big fan of open source software, and it is better. You know, Apple's actually does the same pattern. It's, you know, you don't really hear about it, but the underlying part of iOS is open source. It's a free BSD fork.
It's Darwin. Yeah.
Darwin.
Yeah.
You can get the code. Right. You can inspect those bits, but then there's a layer of stuff that's Apple only, and then you have to get permission to use that part. And Google is less restrictive than that, and that's the, you know, that's the major competition. So it's a trade-off. But it's the fact that it is open source means that you can do lots of interesting things with it, and people still do interesting things with Android. I mean, you know, it's starting to show its age a bit.
And Amazon's doing an interesting thing with Android. I mean, the Fire platform's Android.
Yeah.
And you can even download later after the fact the Google Play Store and get the best of both worlds.
And they are deadly competitors.
Yeah. Man, I wish Greg Farrell were here because he'd convinced me on Sunday. Now you guys are... I am like Donald Trump. I'm a tree that blows in the wind. Whoever I talk to last.
Do you know what, Leo?
Well, it's both. I mean, you know, Android.
Save me, Kevin.
Android is a better world than Microsoft winning would have been.
Yeah.
If we'd had to use Windows LE or whatever it was called.
I think here in the U.S. we have a little bit skewed vision on this because iPhone, while it's not half, it's close to half, and so there really it looks like there's a very good. Reasonable choice here between Android and iOS. And Android, you have all these different manufacturers. It really is a vibrant ecosystem. It feels a lot like Mac and Windows. But I think in the rest of the world, Android is so dominant that maybe there's a different point of view. I don't know.
But you know what, Leo? I would argue that everything, all sin should be forgiven if they come out with a new Pixelbook.
I might agree with you on that. Let's talk a little bit about the data transfer project.
Yeah.
Hath hell frozen over? Does this even to see the Facebook, Google, Microsoft, and Twitter logos on a page all together now? How can this be?
We'll talk about Facebook on it?
Yeah. We'll talk about the DTP in just a bit. But first, a word from Rocket Mortgage, our sponsor for this episode of This Week in Google. If it weren't for our sponsors, we wouldn't have a show. So thank you. Quicken Loans. Now let me tell you why you might want to take advantage of their Rocket Mortgage. Quicken Loans is very, one of the things I admire about Quicken Loans, very customer focused. Typically in the mortgage business, the mortgage folks worry more about interest rates. They're more about their business than they are about you. Because who are you going to call? What are you going to do? You're going to go to someone else? So they kind of dominate. Quicken Loans, which is the biggest lender in the country, got there not just because they have great rates, but because they really are customer forward. They really think about your experience. I'll give you an example. We've talked before about Rocket Mortgage, an entirely online mortgage approval process. You could do it on your phone at an open house, get approval, and buy a house. That is remarkable, given that the industry was, you know, really built around people going to a bank, filling out a long application, getting a lot of paperwork, taking weeks to do it, months in some cases. So Quicken Loans has already cut through the red tape with Rocket Mortgage. Now they want to reduce your anxiety. See, one of the problems, this wasn't a problem until recently, interest rates just started going back up. For a long time, for the last few years, interest rates have been flat. So this anxiety, I remember it because I've been, you know, I remember buying homes in the era where interest rates were going up, you know, half a point every month, it felt like. there's a lot of anxiety when you're shopping for a house and you don't know, you know, is the interest rate going to go up? I got to buy it before it goes up, because even a quarter of a point in interest rate increase means tens of thousands of dollars in expense over the life of the loan. So you want, you know, it's going to be expensive. It's the most expensive thing I'm buying. But you don't want pressure, because it's also the most important thing you're buying. It's the place you're going to live for the next many years. You want to have the luxury of really finding the perfect house. This is how Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage is doing it. They call it the power buying process, and there's two things that happen. First, as always, they'll verify your income, assets, and credit automatically. They have relationships with all the financial institutions. You just have to give them permission. And in less than 24 hours, they'll give you something called a verified approval. Now, the verified approval makes you basic. So you see, there's pre-qualified approval. You get that in minutes. The verified approval within 24 hours, that is basically gives you the strength of a cash buyer. When you're buying a house and the seller sees verified approval, that's a guarantee. You're good for it. You have the money. The loan is already approved. That's fantastic. But the next step, go down one more. After pre-qualified and verified, now we get the Rate Shield approval. Once you're verified, you qualify for this all-new exclusive Rate Shield approval. They lock your rate up for 90 days. 90 days. So that means you have 3 months to shop with no anxiety. You know what your rate's going to be. Actually, there is one exception to that. If the rate goes down, your rate goes down. So you know your rate will never go higher, and you know it might even go lower. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thing you'd expect from America's best mortgage lender. This is called thinking about the customer first. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twig. rocketmortgage.com/twig. Now I have to say the legal stuff. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply. Based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. All you have to remember, rocketmortgage.com/twig. From Quicken Loans, it's Rocket Mortgage, reducing, eliminating the anxiety in home buying. Jeff Jarvis is here from BuzzMachine.com, our good friend, mentor. I would say you're my mentor, Jeff.
No, it's the opposite. You're mine.
What do I know? Kevin Marks, he's a mentor too. He's the king of the open web, indieweb.org. Actually, I want to talk a little more about that in a bit, Kevin. But first, let's talk about this. Google, way back when, was it Brad Fitzpatrick?
Brian Fitzpatrick.
Brian Fitzpatrick, yeah. Who created the Data Liberation Front. This is more than 10 years ago.
Oh, this is way when I was there.
I'll be honest. That's what won me over to Google, period. It's like any company that's committed to me more than its lock-in, I love. And you see so many companies that are all about locking in the, you know, Apple, just lock in. So Fitzpatrick and his team always had this great data liberation front, and even the great name Data Liberation Front, where you could get your data out of Google.
And it's takeout.google.com now is like the actual.
This is actually the old.
That's the old logo. Yeah.
Logo, which is awesome, with a raised fist breaking the shackles.
Binary numbers. Yeah.
Yeah. So this Google became Google Takeout. So they're basically that notion of Google Takeout is now being extended. And I have to think that maybe we can thank GDPR for this a little bit. To the Data Transfer Project. It's datatransferproject.dev. But look who's involved in this. Not just Google. Microsoft, Twitter, and Facebook. They are, quote, committed to building a common framework with open source code that can connect any two online service providers. This is the thing that my jaw dropped. Enabling a seamless, direct, user-initiated portability of data between the two platforms. In other words, no lock-in.
But it's also good for the companies because they have the chance to learn more.
Okay, yeah. So tell me, because I don't buy it.
Right.
Maybe from Google. I don't buy it from the other guy. Why would they do this?
I think it's this, from a consumer perspective, it's like saying, give us your email and we'll tell you who your friends are.
Oh. How so? I mean, from
Because it's not like you can say, I'm going to leave Twitter or whatever I did on Twitter, I can now do on Microsoft.
Right, because they don't have anything.
In that sense, you're not shifting one for one to a new service. It's the same. But instead, if I give permission, if I say that's my data and I want to move it across because I'm going to get benefit there.
Oh, okay.
It's easier for me to think Amazon in a way, but it's not one of the players.
So interestingly, none of these guys, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, or Twitter, really are in direct competition, except maybe Google and Microsoft.
Yeah, Microsoft wishes.
Not even there, really.
Yeah. Google Plus.
Bits of them because they're both conglomerates,
Well, but I mean, Microsoft's Azure and Google's services maybe a little bit, right? But Amazon's the 1,000-pound giant.
That's the ones they're really competing with. Yeah.
Yeah. So okay. No,
I mean, even looking at this white paper, I'm getting flashbacks to Open Social and some of the same diagrams that we were using then, which is 10 years ago.
Open Social is a federated Twitter, basically.
Well, Open Social was our attempt to do a unified API for different social network sites so that you could write an app and run it in mobile different social network sites.
And Mastodon is an example, and I mean, there are many examples.
No, this was the Google project I worked on 10 years ago when I was at Google. Not IndieWeb, Open Social.
But isn't that...
Yeah, I remember that.
Isn't that GNU Social and all of those? Aren't those Open Social?
No, not really.
Oh,
there's bits of it that have... There's some kind
Identica
of chain of...
and Mastodon.
Yeah. Mastodon is built on Activity Streams and WebFinger and the OStatus stack, and it's now built on ActivityPub, which is a suggested. So there's a set of protocols there.
So GNU Social and Mastodon, they're all...
Kind of with each other.
Oh, okay.
So there's a chain of these different protocols that we've been building for a long time, and there's some overlap between them. So this is another attempt to do this, but this is not trying to solve that problem to the same extent as Jeff said. It's more about import export and data portability and that stuff. Facebook was like the big company that did that. They bought up all the other companies that were doing address book import export, OctaZen and two or three others, and made that their core focus of Facebook. And the competitors to Facebook have been ones that use your phone address book directly as your source of knowledge, as opposed to something held by Facebook in the cloud. And then Facebook bought a couple of those as well. That's basically what WhatsApp did. They said phone numbers are your identity and your address book of contacts through phone numbers is your graph, and we'll use that as a thing.
So I completely then, this is not the blue moon event that I thought it was. This is just...
It's the start of something good.
I always approve of it when companies try and do these kinds of things. If we can get better interoperability, that's great. And the actual work of it is lots of very, very boring discussions about what you call someone's first name and last name and how you structure things like that. We've been through enough of those over the years.
Here's an example. Hypothetical example, this is from the white paper. A Google Photos user wants to move their photos to OneDrive, to Microsoft. They go to Google's file transfer interface, choose the destination OneDrive, and hit send. I mean, that's moving off of Google Photos. They're making it easier to leave.
They're making it easier. Google has already had this with takeout.
Right. That's why it's more surprising to hear Microsoft saying, okay, we're going to do this with Google, or Facebook saying, okay, we're going to do this. Than Google. Google's the one that's always been kind of in favor of this. Although, takeout delivers it in an XML or a CSV and some kind of bland data format that you then have to figure out how to import. And it's not.
Yeah, you have to download it, but also it gives in something that somebody can write something against. The theory here is they're going to write a common API in the middle that you can move stuff directly, but then you have all the mapping problems that you have with those kinds of APIs,
right?
Which is not trivial, but it's doable.
So instead of writing an individual adapter, in effect, that says, okay, here's how I port my Twitter graph to my Facebook graph, the companies will do that all for you transparently.
Except that's the bit they won't give you. this week, I put two things in the timeline for this. Both Facebook and Twitter have locked down their developer APIs even further.
That's right.
They're under Facebook. Facebook moves to restrict its API. Basically, Bridgy, which is one of the IndieWeb projects that's used to move comments back and forth between Facebook and Twitter, is having to give up on using Facebook because the new API restrictions that Facebook has put to fight Cambridge Analytica mean that actually they're breaking all these APIs. And Twitter has just announced that they're limiting all their APIs notionally to fight bots and spam. But in practice, it means that Nota Live that I used to live tweet is going to be against their rules. I mean, I got shut down using it in Dubai last month because they thought I looked like a bot. And now they're explicitly saying if you build an app that posts more than 300 times in 3 hours, then you're going to be shut down.
Well, that seems fair. I mean, who would want to post more than 300 times in 3 hours?
Well, if I'm live tweeting a conference as I do, I can quite easily write.
I've hit an old limit. Yeah. Oh.
So
it depends. You know, it depends what you. You know, it's like any of these things. It's like as soon as you try and write a rule, you're going to catch some people who are using the platform in productive ways, as well as people who are using it for spam. Sorry.
So, should I still say this is a good thing, but it's not as good as I thought it was.
it's promising, and we're going to keep an eye on it. Good. But the underlying challenge, the hard challenge, is understanding when the computer is actually acting on your behalf and when it isn't. And this is the sort of the deep flaw that comes from Unix permissions model of, well, if I'm running this program, it's running as me. And if I wanted to run it as something else, I can SU it and run it as the super user. And the challenge is that that isn't true for ordinary users. That's a very programmable worldview. But the answer is not do not give users the power to do this kind of thing. It's make it clear which ones are doing what. And that's the, you know, I think the takeout stuff is fairly clear that you are dumping out everything you ever put into this site and getting it back. And the Facebook data dump has got better at that as well. But they're still in this, they're still in this weird form. Facebook's is particularly noxious in that they will give you your half of all your conversations. They will turn all links to other people into just their names. And so they're sort of stripping it of any context and just giving you a textual version of it, in effect.
Kevin, are there potential businesses that can be built on top of this? You know, I add value to your photos in some way. Give me all your tweets, and I can do something with them.
Sure. I mean, in theory, there are, and the challenge is, you know, and that's actually this is part of the GDPR rule set as well. I mean, part of the reason that I suspect that they're looking at this more closely.
Good point.
Adding some of this. There's data portability is one of the pillars of GDPR.
Yes.
Working out how to do that.
That's kind of what I thought is this is a little GDPR response.
And we've had things like that here with mandated transfer of data for things like power companies and some kinds of financial services in the UK and EU as well. So if we can do it, it's great. If you can actually define something to move something back and forth without having to write a custom import script for every combination, that is a great thing. You know? I've spent a chunk of my life try to help build those kinds of standards, and some of them work better than others. But the challenge is always, you know, there are two challenges. One is, do you actually have a mutually coherent data model? And the other one is this permissions thing of, is this app acting as me, or is this app exploiting me for some other purpose? And that's the piece that Facebook swung too far one way, is now swinging too far back the other way.
All right, we have a bunch of we got to get Jeff out of here in the next half hour, so we're gonna trot through.
By the way, Facebook stock is now down 20%.
Wow! See, I feel like
buy,
that's,
I think.
Well, but I think that's not a response, obviously, to the quarterly results. I mean, it's approximate to, but I think it's also just a general feeling of malaise.
Well,
about
this
Facebook's
is from
future.
From market from the announcement. It took a hit right then and there. And that's loss of 143 billion market cap.
Well, I hope my blind trust buys some Facebook stock right now.
Yeah.
Too bad it's not run by the Russians. Go ahead, Kevin. I mean,
this is weird after hour trading stuff. This is not actual.
Yeah, that's right.
It's after hours trading.
Way after hours, yeah. Hey, good news. 24 people have now been sentenced in India for pretending to be the IRS. I love it when these things get shut down. I actually held little hope, but some of these people are getting prison sentences ranging from 4 to 20 years. The lead defendant, M. Patel, was given 20 years in jail. He ran a team of runners from Chicago that helped receive and launder the proceeds. They pretended to be the IRS and the U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services, which is terrible, to take advantage of people's fears. It's a good thing. Good thing. Glad they did that. Let's see what else here. Good news for people who believe in two-factor. Google says that after employing hardware keys for 85,000-plus employees, not a single one of them was phished. That's since early 2017. They started using the YubiKey. This is from Brian Krebs, Krebs on Security. And now word that Google is going to make their own. This is bad news for YubiKey. Unfortunately, YubiKey, which kind of created, and I use these YubiKeys, created a hardware key that provides a second factor. Now Google apparently is going to offer something they call the Titan key, which includes...
They've been giving that one out at various
have
events.
They? Yeah, it's yeah. not yet public, but eventually you'll be able to get it. They it does both Bluetooth. I think there's two keys. And this yes. is what Google requires if you use their hardcore authentication. Which I tried for about a day until I realized that it broke everything. But you can use Bluetooth. You need Bluetooth for something like an iPhone, which has no USB access. And then the other one is just a hardware USB key, type A key, but you get an adapter. You press the button on the Titan, and it I'm not sure if it's like the YubiKey that it generates new one-time passwords all the time. The original YubiKey was just a single long string, like a typewriter. Then they got some smarts in there, a processor in there, and it was doing one-time passwords. I'm not clear on whether the Titan security key will do that. But knowing it's Google, I think they probably will. It's a little more bulky than the YubiKey. They say they'll be selling it by the end of summer. I keep my YubiKey. Oh, I don't have my YubiKey on me. I have it in my briefcase. Keep it on me at all times. But there's just the point is that it's even better than just an authenticator for two-factor, and just not basically not fishable.
So I got a fishing attempt today. I think. Let me try this out on you. Critical security alert: sign-in attempt was blocked.
From
Google blocked them, but yeah. You should check what happened.
But
check
activity. You should click this link, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
But it was well done. This one was well done. There were, you know, fewer spelling errors.
I got one that was really well done that almost bit me. No, actually, it didn't almost bite me, but it was pretty terrible. It says, hi. Well, actually, the subject is a password. Your password is, and it was a password I used on sites I really didn't care about. A long time ago. I haven't used it in ages, but it was one of my passwords. Your password is this.
That gets your attention, yeah.
That got my attention. And it said, so we figured out your password, and you were logging in when you were logging into this porn site. We hacked your system. We made a video of you looking at the porn site and of the porn site. And, oh, by the way, we got all of your contacts. And if you don't send us $2,000 in Bitcoin in the next 48 hours, we're going to send this video to everybody in your contact list.
Huh.
So combine that with the fact that it is my password. It's not.
Which they got from one of the password phishing sites.
Which, and of course, this is the thing. And I bet you this really works. Because, yeah, if you know, all these data breaches, if you go to Have I Been Pwned, you'll see that your email address, the one they used, and some of your passwords were leaked from Target and all these other places. And, of course, if you reused your password on an adult site, then maybe this would be credible. You don't remember. So I bet you what they did is they go through the database of, you know, breaches, get all the passwords and emails, and just send this email to everybody. And I bet you it works pretty darn good. $2,000. The only thing is you have to figure out how to send Bitcoin. And I bet that's the only thing that kept them from making millions off of this scam.
Yeah.
Needless to say, I didn't send them anything. So if you get any emails with videos of me, please destroy those immediately. I thought that was a really good scam. I was pretty
impressed. Because you can imagine the galvanic skin response goes,
yeah, because it looks legitimate, right?
But the entire web is full of videos of you, Leo. I mean, they could just send out old episodes of
Twitter. I know. Oh, wait a minute. Here's an article from theindependent.co.uk about this very scam, the sextortion scam. Danny Bradbury knows your password, but don't fall for it. Oh, yeah, this is the one I got. This is exactly the one I got.
Because the thing is, there are enough password leak dumps from something you logged into a while ago.
Fortunately, I'm sophisticated enough that I immediately grokked what had happened and just ignored it. But I have to admit, I thought for a minute, well, could that actually have happened? This is exactly... Oh, except that Brian Krebs only asked for $1,400. The one I got was for $2,000. But they do say, if you don't know how to send Bitcoin, click this link for a video that will explain it. Which means I bet they got very few responses. I don't know. Maybe they made some money. All three recipients who sent their this email to Brian Krebs said that the password was close to 10 years old and none of them had been used any time in their current computers. And that's exactly the case with me. It's clearly from a password dump from ages ago. But this is why you don't use the same password over and over. According to the FBI, never send compromising images of yourself to anyone, no matter who they are or who they say they are. Don't open attachments with people you don't know and turn off. By the way, that's bad advice because the attachments are always from people you know who have been hacked. And in general, be wary of opening attachments even from those you do know. I think be more wary of ones from people you do know. Turn off and or cover any web cameras when you're not using them, especially if you're pleasuring yourself. I have never put tape over my cameras, but I guess maybe I should. So just a word of warning, if you get that email, you're not alone. A lot of people getting it, and that's exactly you got it immediately, Kevin. You knew.
Yeah. No, and that's I got a really annoying one last week, rather my wife did. Somebody signed up for eBay with her email address.
Whoa.
Which is the XKCD reverse identity theft problem. But the thing is, eBay does not send you an email saying, please verify your email address, and give you a link saying, no, this is a mistake.
So stupid.
And they allow people to start bidding on things before they verify the email
address. Oh, because I get emails all the time like that. Oh, you just signed up for, please confirm your address. Because my email address is very, very well known, and I just figure, screw it. But that's one to know about. You could bid. Mm. Wow.
Yeah, so my wife was getting all these things. So I eventually went in, took over their account with her email, with the email address because I could.
Yep.
And then changed the email address to the name of the CEO of eBay at gmail.com. So we'll see how
because it really is Gmail's fault. They're not doing the right thing. They're not authenticating.
No, it's not Gmail's fault. No, it's eBay's fault. eBay.
I meant eBay. They should not allow you to bid until the email's been authenticated and the password's been set up and all that.
But also, and this is one for the engineers listening. When you send out an email saying please verify this email, give me a button to say no, I do not verify this email.
Good point.
Because this is a structural problem. People can sign you up
good
to stuff.
Good point.
And you're about to say, no, not me.
Waymo has Phoenix, Arizona, and its environs are now becoming the place for self-driving vehicles. So a word of warning to pedestrians. Waymo, Google's self-driving car, is now down there. And this is the strangest thing. They've done a deal with Walmart. You can go to walmart.com, order groceries. A self-driving Waymo will appear. It's not clear whether there's a safety driver or it's just an empty car. Will appear at your door. You get in. It takes you to Walmart where you pick up your groceries and takes you back. Clearly, this is a completely unnecessary trip.
Yeah.
But I realize the point of which is to get you used to the idea of getting in a self-driving vehicle and letting it take you somewhere and back. Right?
Right.
That's weird.
It's a very, they're also, this one makes more sense. They're going to do it with a rental car agency. So it'll take you to the rental agency. That makes sense because you need a car and you can't get there.
Yeah.
The guy who said Amazon should replace libraries.
Yeah.
Oh, I know you use cookies, Fast Company. It's okay. Does anybody like when those cookie things come up? There's usually not a like. No, I don't want to use cookies. It's just like click X.
But under GDPR, you can't require it for entry anymore.
Yeah, which is why I can't read Trunk anymore.
Right.
Not missing it, actually.
No. Trunk just fired half of the Daily News newsroom, including the editor-in-chief.
When I was there at the Daily News, we had 450 people in the newsroom. Now they have 45.
45, one-tenth the number.
Yep.
And there was somebody wrote a great article saying all this money is going straight to the guy they fired for being a groper because he got a $15 million settlement. Yeah.
He got a huge settlement. And, by the way, Trunk went gravely into debt to buy all these companies. So it's his parachute and debt service.
Yep.
Anyway, the Forbes contributor who wrote that article saying Amazon should replace local libraries to save taxpayers' money, the piece was immediately pulled down. However, preserved for posterity by Fast Company. So just remember, when you write something stupid, it's never going to die.
That's the problem with the Forbes contributor network.
I saw something
that said that this guy, I don't know if it's true or not, but that this guy paid to be in it.
Right. I bet that's true. Wouldn't be surprised. Do they vet these people at all?
They say they do, but...
Well, some they do.
Some they do. There's tiers, right? There's a Forbes staffer who's good. Then there's kind of selected Forbes contributors whom they actually do select and they pay. And then there's
this guy.
People who are good, but schmutz to them. They're idiots.
They must pay, because what would Forbes' interest in doing it be unless they could make some money on it? Or maybe it's just free content.
Oh, it's free content. Louis Dvorkin, who was also at Trunk and took over the LA Times for about 2 hours. This was his brain fart. Yeah. And it massively increased the amount of content they got.
Yeah, even though it's bad content, who cares, right? It's more
much of it is. So the problem is, you just don't know.
You don't know before
you go.
If I see
a Forbes link, it might be okay, but it might be crap.
It's usually amusing.
But that's the point. But this is the structural problem I was talking about at the beginning. Is that they're optimizing for people being idiots about libraries? So they found some.
You think that's
some drunk economist in Long Island who's worried that
another thing. It's just a bunch of homeless people in the library and a bunch of dead trees. go to Starbucks instead.
Dust all over.
It's dust.
This is what passes for discourse now.
I know. It's so pathetic. That's why you got to watch this show, because this is good stuff.
What's his face? I'm just still feeling.
Are you worried?
Clive Thompson.
Go ahead.
Just posted a great link about this, which is, I will send you the link.
Put it in the chat room, as you have been. You're so good. Kevin spends a lot of time in our chat room.
Hang on. So this is sort of symptomatic of this, an interesting culture clash. So Clive, there's a large profile about Goop and Gwyneth Paltrow in the New York Times.
I was reading this.
But Clive has pulled out this piece with saying Goop was originally partnered with Condé Nast, but Gwyneth would objected to them fact-checking the articles.
Yes, because...
How dare Condé Nast?
Goop is full of all sorts of bizarre propositions about
things
to put in your hoo-ha and stuff.
Yes.
The other thing I learned from this is...
Clive's thread rather than this, because he talks about how fact-checking actually works in reputable magazines,
awesome.
It was.
I wrote a piece for the AARP magazine, and I got like three or four a piece. By the way, they have very strict rules about attribution. It was a 500 word piece. It was really short, but there were facts in it. So I made sure I had footnotes and the attribution and everything. I still got called by the fact checker, which I welcomed. I thought it was great because I had asserted that the Zenith TV that I watched the moon landing on was actually lower resolution than my Apple Watch. So... I wrote a fairly long email explaining, there's apples and oranges because that's scan lines versus dots, but effectively it was. And they said, okay, good. I said, you know, you could, if you're worried about it, just you could say approximately. I think that's what they ended up doing. What I didn't know is that Goop comes from Gwyneth Paltrow's initials, GP. And that you add the double O's because somebody told her that if you're gonna be a successful internet company, you have to have double O's. Okay. Goop. It's fascinating. Fascinating.
I was in Aspen, you know, a few weeks ago, and of course they have a Goop store. Of course.
Did you pick up a yoni egg while you were there?
I know.
How about a rose quartz soothing face massage roller?
Well, if only I had, I wouldn't be pink.
The jade egg, the rose quartz soothing massage roller, all on display at Goop's Wellness Summit in Los Angeles in June. Well, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, well, you know what? Fact checking can be a pain. Because it just, you know, sometimes you just want to say what you want to say. Orrin Hatch is not dead. He tweeted, he said, Google, we should talk. But really, he should have mentioned it to Wikipedia because as you can
exactly,
see,
that's where it comes from.
This snippet is a Wikipedia article that says Orrin Hatch died September 11th, 2017, which was, you know, with Wikipedia, it was probably some wag.
Well, those aren't all Wikipedia. So they do get some of them by parsing them off the web.
Yeah.
So, who knows?
Anyway, he's not dead, nor is Fish.
So this is the famous episode of this where People magazine, when I was there, killed off Abe Vigoda. And he then bought an ad in Variety of him sitting in a casket reading People.
Is there a website that
if you go to isabevagodadead.com?
Yeah. Let's just check. Oh, he did. He passed away.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, here you go. Isabevagodadead.com? Yes. The site's a simple site, easy to maintain. Probably won't be changing again.
Is it HTTPS or not?
Oh, God. I don't know. Should we look at the source?
It's going to be bad for you.
Should we look at the source code? It's probably... It's HTTPS. I'm not getting a warning. Oh no, I'm on Microsoft's Edge browser. See, they don't tell you about that stuff. I have to say, I am tempted not to use Chrome just because of that.
Oh puff.
I'm a puff.
Oh puff.
I'm a puffta.
I think Firefox is starting to do it too. So
yeah, everybody's going to do it eventually. Now. Yeah. What else? Is there anything else before we wrap this up? It's precious close to your deadline.
You do a good job, boss. You got the good stuff.
I got the good stuff.
I got the good stuff.
Final preview of Android P has just been released. Getting ready. This is it. They say we're going to ship probably. This is developer preview 4, public beta. Developer preview 5, public beta 4, final system behaviors. I love Android 9. I'm very happy with it. It's been very stable.
I want to go ahead and put it on my main phone.
Yeah, it's been on my main phone. It's very stable.
I have it on my secondary phone.
Yeah. I love the swiping to go to previous. Anyway, the features, the digital wellness features they talked about, the app timers, the dashboard that breaks down usage, will not be in the public release. They will be out this fall. Probably with the Pixel 3 and Android 9.1. And no, it's still Android P, the worst code name ever. We don't yet know what it is, but it will soon be done. It's cooked. Your P is done. Anything else? We talked about everything. I don't care about Facebook parties. Who cares?
Because it's not, they're launching it, but I try to get onto it. It's not out yet, so we can't play with it. Well, I thought it'd be fun if we got on the show, if we could all watch the same thing. I wouldn't be able to.
You'd be leaving me
right.
out.
And Kevin can't because it's not in the U.S. It's only in the U.S.
In the U.K., yeah.
Well, I'm sort of mysteriously sometimes in the U.S. I have this problem that I can't install apps on my phone that are U.K. only because as far as Google Store thinks, I'm in the U.S. But it doesn't actually say this. It says, this doesn't work in your country. And I'm like, which one of my countries?
Yes. So I just went on to BBC through Tunnel Bear, thinking, and then they've changed it now. So you have to say, yes, I'm a license holder.
Didn't
you used to have to do that.
No, you don't.
You could lie. It
depends what you're watching. On iPlayer, you do. Yeah.
Yeah. Comcast is giving up its bid to buy 21st Century Fox's assets. Thank God Disney is the winner.
They're going to go after Sky.
Going to go after Sky. Comcast, of course, after the Time Warner AT&T merger was approved by a judge immediately, filed a $65 billion bid. Disney upped its offer to $71.3 billion. You know, at this point, Disney should be able to go back to their original bid. But
yeah,
it's you wonder, is it a little collusion? And congratulations to Susan Fowler. She wrote the very famous memo that brought Travis Kalanick down at Uber. She was just hired by the New York Times. She's going to be writing about technology based in San Francisco, the Times technology opinion editor. We should get her on one of our shows now.
That'd be great.
Yes. She's Susan Fowler Rigetti.
Yes.
But we know her as Susan Fowler for her memo. Gosh, it was only in February 2017 that she wrote that memo. But
yeah, she spoke at a conference I was at like the week before and was talking about microservices and very hardcore technical standard stuff. And then the next week she suddenly, about her work at Uber, in fact.
Yeah.
And then next week she published this thing and it's now... Now a professional journalist, which is quite a transition.
What do you think of the CJR article by James Ball? We need a new model for tech journalism.
I haven't seen this one. Where is this?
Well, I figured Jeff must have seen it.
Yeah. On the one hand,
he says we've whiplashed our readers by first singing the praises of tech and then now coming down hard on Google and Facebook and all that.
That's sort of overboard on both ends.
Yeah, that's sort of true. Yeah.
James Ball's a good journalist. Ex-Guardian.
So, TLDR it. He says, ending technology journalism as we know it won't save tech, let alone the world, but it might be a good first step. That worries me. That worries me a little bit. There will always be another product launch, another set of results. Talked about both today. Another patch or redesign. Another international conference to keep the beat writers, well, beaten down. Different younger reporters. Yes, I agree. Should cover that kind of incremental change. It's a way to cut their teeth. Or better yet, let's step back from product news and let companies do their own PR. Well, I kind of agree with that. But then what are we going to talk about? I think more than most tech journalists... Certainly on this show, and I think it kind of on all of our shows, we talk more about a higher level stuff than just like new product stuff.
Yeah.
We talk more about what it means. If you watched last week, Mike Elgin mentioned how he lives in Chrome and the Chrome extensions he uses. He's made now a list of it.
We did it.
Yes.
Oh, good.
Elgin.com, Chrome extensions. But I want to tell you that he will be on Twitter on Sunday with Jason Calacanis. That's going to be a hell of a show. And he'll talk about his list, including Facebook purity. added FB purity to my browser. It stands not for Facebook, but fluff busting. Facebook without the junk. FB purity. What? If only I had Facebook, I could find out what that's all about.
It's even purer if you delete it completely.
I didn't delete Facebook. I deactivated it because this is a bad thing because I thought I'd just log in quickly to check something. I didn't want to lose my name. So I just, it's a ghost account. That's okay, right?
No.
Jeff, I know you're...
It's a new form of snobbery. It's like saying, I don't have a TV.
I know, it's the worst kind of snobbery.
I only watch PBS.
I don't listen to podcasts. I only listen to NPR. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, it is 3:30. It's time to say what?
Your presence is so horrendously insipid now.
What?
What do you mean? It's just happy birthdays and it's ridiculous happy birthday things.
Wait a minute. You can go to my page?
Yeah, I'm in Leo Laporte right now.
Wait, how can you go to my page?
I typed in Leo Laporte and I got Leo Laporte, man.
It's probably some other Leo Laporte.
No, oh,
that's
you.
I don't know.
Your presence makes you look like a dork.
Why don't we're going to let you go, Jeff? So why don't you give us your number?
Okay. I'll give you a bonus.
A bonus.
My favorite little thing of the week. I'm a non-number one, but I like this. So where was it here? So somebody on Twitter posted this. I loved it. Timo Grün posted this at a German bakery.
Yeah.
A Datenschutzgrundverordnung, a data protection basic right. Achtung, in our bakery, we are likely to recognize you by name and your favorite baked good. If you do not want this, shout as soon as you enter, I do not agree. And we will try our best to not know you.
Can we print this out in the original German and put it on the door? Yes.
Achtung.
Achtung.
In unserer Bäckerei werden Sie auch gelegentlich mit dem Namen angesprochen und wir merken uns, welches Ihr Lieblingsgebäck ist.
We will
Sollten
know.
Sie das nicht wollen, rufen Sie einfach beim Betreten, ich bin nicht einverstanden.
We'll know if every once in a while somebody shouts, ich bin nicht einverstanden, that they read German.
Oh, I just love that so much. It's not a number, but I love it.
I want to print that sucker out. Thank you. I'll let you go, Jeff, because I know you got to get out of here.
Thank you very much.
Take care, Jeff Jarvis.
Good to see you.
BuzzerMachine.com at Jeff Jarvis on the Twitter. Tweet him your best GDPR anecdotes. Thank you, Jeff. Kevin Marks, we got to mention IndieWeb.org because that's fighting the good fight to keep the web free, open.
Yes.
People focused.
And there's events tonight in various places. If you click on events, Homebrew Website Club. Let's see.
It's coming up in Nuremberg, a virtualized on CET, London, Baltimore, virtual on Pacific Time, San Francisco, Seattle area. Is that all the same meeting?
Tonight. It's in all these places. Nuremberg's already happened, I think.
Yeah.
And London, but Baltimore is ongoing. San Francisco is starting in a while.
Oh, nice. At Mozilla. So,
and then there's another thing that's happening on the 31st, which is the Decentralized Web Hackers Day, which is the day before the Decentralized Web Summit thing at the Internet Archive. So they're putting a day together at that. So it's a whole day for doing like a mini indie web hacking camp. In San Francisco. So if you're in San Francisco, go along to that. And then there's the same night, there's a party at the Internet Archive for the decentralized web thing. So that's the event of the next couple of weeks. And then other things. I had a couple of other things. Oh, yes. So there's a couple of little browsery things. There's this thing called Kill Sticky. And so we were talking about... The problem with every time I go to an American newspaper, it covers the page with crap about PR that I can't be bothered to go through.
Yes.
This gets rid of quite a lot of them. It basically takes anything on the page that doesn't scroll when you scroll. It makes those disappear.
It's a bookmarklet, so you could just put it on your browser toolbar and then click it whenever you don't like.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. So it works for Medium. It works for, like lots of these sites you click to and... Before you can read anything, the screen is covered with bits and bobs. And this gets rid of those bits and bobs.
And it's really just about six lines of JavaScript. It's not a big deal. You could...
This is old. This is something I wrote 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And another bookmarkler. I'm bringing bookmarks.
Oh, it is old. This is from 2013.
Yeah. That's
just, you know. Been a problem for a long time. Wow.
And another old bookmarklet is the contrast widget that Ada wrote. What this one does is when you click it, it tells you which bits of your website need better contrast. So if you click the highlight low contrast elements button in the corner. Ugh.
Yeah.
Down the bottom, screen just scroll it a little bit. It shows you which ones are too low contrast.
Yeah.
So that would have worked very well on those Google results you were showing us where they were put all the numbers in gray on gray.
Right. This is good.
This is stressful thing to take when someone hands you a new website design. You're like, why can't I read this?
Yeah, this is ADA.IS. Ada. Yes. Is it American Disability Act or is it just a woman named Ada?
It's Ada Rose Cannon, who works at Samsung.
It's convenient cool that she is named Ada and can help with the ADA. At least there we for go. People who hate low contrast sites. Yeah, yeah. Kevin, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate all you do for the open web. I'm sad about Bridgie. I feel like a lot of those technologies. How's PubHub SubBub? Hub Sub PubBub PubAdub.
Hub Sub PubHub is now a web sub, is a W3C standard, and okay. We've got a new thing that's underway called MicroSub, which is trying to give you a way to do feed reading again, but to separate the feed fetching part and the UI so that we can write a couple of things that do the feed fetching and then have different UIs that work against it. So if you're pining for Google Reader and the feed reading, MicroSub is the thing to look at there.
MicroSub.
Yes.
I still have my with known site. Has Ben Wertmuller kind of given up on that, or is that still a thing?
Ben is doing other things. He's working for Matter, the media VC.
I like Matter. Yeah.
You should go to their demo days. Okay. But it's an open source project. It's still going, but they're no longer accepting new signups, so you have to install it yourself. But it's still running. And you can install it on different hosting platforms.
My known site slowly is falling apart. It just doesn't. The images don't work. Everything's broken now. So I guess I'll probably abandon it. That's sad. Or run it myself. But there,
move it to your own hosting. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's the way to do it. Yeah. withknown.com. Thank you, Kevin. Wonderful, wonderful evening. Thank you for staying up late with us. Kevin Marks is at indieweb.org and at Kevin Marks on the Twitter.
And kevinmarks.com.
And kevinmarks.com. So forget that a pay us a pig anything. It's all there. Well, it's all at Kevin Marks.
I link to it.
Yeah. It's all at kevinmarks.com. That's a little easier. Thank you, Kevin.
Cheers.
We do This Week in Google every Wednesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you want to watch us do it live, you can in our live stream, which is you. By the way, somebody's pointing out we have an old site, live.twit.tv, which is not HTTPS and is now marked as insecure. But, you know, I kept it up because it has an old player that some people preferred. But really, the site, which is secure and is, you know, not going to be dinged by Google, is twit.tv/live. You'll find links there to all of our video and audio feeds, so you can choose the one you like the best and sing along as we do the show. If you do that, do definitely join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You can also visit live. Our studio's open. If you are going to be in the Petaluma, California area, about an hour north of San Francisco, just email tickets at twit.tv. Let us know you're coming. We'll put a chair out for you. You can also, of course, get on-demand audio and video of everything we do, including this show, at twit.tv. In this case, twit.tv/twig. And actually, subscribing is another good way. In fact, I recommend it. If you've got a podcast app that you really like, just subscribe. And you'll get it as soon as it's done every week, audio or video, on demand. Listen at your leisure. And you can, of course, always ask your smart assistant, you know, the Google Home or the Amazon Echo or your Apple HomePod. You can always, or even your computer or phone, you can always say, hey, you know who, listen to This Week in Google. And that'll happen. It might sneeze. I hope your cold gets better, Kevin. Have a great week.
I thought I was muted there.
We'll see you next time. I wish that the Echo sneezed. Can we add that?
Didn't it?
We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.